This is the Scottish Football Marketing Podcast, a podcast for clubs at all levels in Scotland, providing inspiration, advice and marketing tips. On this show, Chris Sampson and I were joined by Ryan Murren, formerly of Brentford and Motherwell. We spoke to Ryan about fan engagement and his experiences of implementing change on the front line. As always, we'd love a review or to subscribe. Even better still, a recommendation to someone else in your club to give us a listen. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to another episode of the Scottish Football Marketing Podcast. I'm Chris Sampson from Sports Marketing Scotland, and I'm joined by Michael Bockel from the Scottish FA. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
We've got Ryan Morant on with us tonight, and we're going to be talking all about fan experience and fan engagement. We'll hear from him a bit more in a second, but throughout his career in football, he's been focusing on improving the experiences that fans have at games. It's so important, isn't it, Michael, especially nowadays in football?
Ah, it certainly is. I think it's something that we've talked about on this podcast before. We've had some guests on before. We had Mark Bradley when we first started the podcast. And I think having Ryan on, who's somebody that's been working on the front line at clubs in both Scotland and down in England, it would be a great addition to take us through his experiences of what's worked and also crucially what's perhaps not worked and the lessons that have come from that.
Yeah, definitely. Ryan, welcome to the podcast.
Hi there.
Take us through, Michael just alluded to it, but take us through your career in football to date. It's been quite a busy one, hasn't it?
Yeah, I've become a bit of a Dean Windass of the marketing world within football, I think, with moving clubs. But I've worked for about 8 years within football. I started at Aldershot, and when they were bottom of League Two, the fourth tier in England. So it was a bit of a I couldn't have started with a harder job, I don't think, but. I moved up to Crawley when the CEO left, and then I've worked at Southend, up to Doncaster if I'm putting on my northern voice, and then in fact before I joined Doncaster, Alan Burrows and I met about me coming up to Motherwell, but things didn't fall right, so it wasn't until I left. And then Alan got back in touch, and I ended up coming up to Motherwell for just under 18 months, I think it was. And then I moved back down south and took a job at Brentford there. So it's been quite a journey. But and every club's got different positives and negatives. But every club I've worked at's had the same challenge, and that's been trying to get fans through the door. Earlier, trying to get new fans on board, and also looking after the more loyal fans. So it's wherever you're at, the problems, good or bad, are quite scalable. So
has that always been your focus when you've been at each club as well? In terms of, has it always been in marketing and comms and fan kind of engagement?
Yeah, I mean my first roles were in marketing specifically. And then when I moved up to Doncaster, that became more of a sort of head of communications role there. So that was looking after the marketing and the media side, and that was a massive. I learned a hell of a lot at Doncaster. I mean, there was two managers there, and both fiery Scotsmen actually, in Paul Dickoff and Darren Ferguson, who, but both great guys, but also had the ability to scare the life out of you. So, that was a broader role. And then when I moved to Motherwell and down to Brentford, it just became more fan centric, really, which I think is as you're seeing across not just football but every single industry and every sport and every industry is just realizing you have to. Look after your supporters of its sport or customers if you're if you're in retail or something like that. So I think people are realizing that there's so much competition out there for whatever it may be from competitors that you've got to make sure you're looking after those that are loyal to you, really.
Taking it down to a simpler level at the start, fan engagement, what does it mean to you?
To me, fan engagement is. It's about creating a relationship, recognizing loyalty, recognizing what new fans want, and not forcing. Letting the transactions come over time. I think what people try and do is they see fan engagement and they launch an app and go, this is a fan engagement app, which to me is utter rubbish, really, because to me it has to be authentic. The relationship between the club and the fans has to be authentic. It can't be something that is forced. It can't be something that is bought. You can't be asking people to spend money with you to be engaged. It's about listening to what the fans want and delivering on it. Nothing more detailed than that, really, from my opinion. Because I mean, I've supported, and I know I go on about it a lot, but I mean, I've supported Leicester since I was four, and in the same way that everyone else would, you know, might have supported their team, you know, since young age, and it has to be. You have to get a relationship with those fans, whether they're 40 coming for the first time or whether they're four coming for the first time, so the club has an identity for them and it can be relatable. Really, I think there's a lot of clubs out there, probably bigger clubs, that, you know, try and launch these apps and these the paywalls and stuff like that to try and engage your fans, and it's not the right way to do it at all. That's a transaction, and in my opinion is that transactions will come over time if you get things right at the start.
Something that seems to have been kind of synonymous with your time working in football so far is the EFL's awards around fan and family experience. Can you talk us through just what that is and why you think it's important?
Yeah, I mean, what it is, you mentioned Mark Bradley earlier. I mean, he, 11 years ago now, this might even be the 12th, started working with the Football League and just trying to set taking supporter service or taking customer service and turning that into supporter service, really, and just recognizing the touch points that when a fan wants to find some information about when a game is to when they eventually buy a ticket and when they leave the stadium is what that experience is like, and what are the touch points, are the staff helpful? Is it easy to get a ticket? Is information easy to find? If I'm bringing my partner and she wants to know a bit about it, what can she find out about the game and what you expect at the club? If you're in your family, what can they expect? What food's on offer? Especially this day and age, you know, it's so competitive for refreshment wise. You need to be transparent with what you're offering people, and just trying to, with those awards, they've just built a. It's not perfect, but they've just built a system that allows clubs at any level to think, actually, do you know what? Are we reaching fans in the right way with our website messaging? Are we sending the right emails? Have we got enough on for families on a match day before the game, after the game? Is there enough content for families to be reading? And families don't necessarily want to buy a program anymore. They want to read stuff online. Have they got online content? And are the staff and the stewards, are they on board with it? Because a lot of the time, you know, staff and stewards can be, or Saturday staff stewards can be brilliant. I'll put that in first. But a lot of the time, and, you know, I know this from my time in Scotland, that they can be, and this is across every club I've worked in, they can also be heroes that put on a yellow jacket and want to fight the world. And you have to make sure that every single person at the club is on board with what the club are trying to do. Otherwise it doesn't, you know, penetrate. And that's what the strategy that Mark's put into the EFL, that's what they work with every single club, just to actually, we're not telling you to do this, but it's basically just a best practice guideline that recognises clubs for what they're doing, not just one-offs, but, you know, from more of a strategic point of view. So that it's not just, oh, we know we're going to get assessed in a couple of months, let's do everything right. It's to make sure that you're doing things right across the whole of the season, you know, and beyond that. So they're quite powerful. They're quite interesting. They're quite damning if you get things wrong. But I think a lot of, I know Mark started to do a lot of work with other countries, and I think he started to do some up there too. But the best practice that they offer, I think, is the right way. Is the right way to go. If you wanted a long answer, that was.
That's all good. You touched on it. You spent the last, your last club was at Brentford. Can you take us through what you did there and some of the things that you introduced in your time there?
Yeah, I mean, Brentford's, to be honest with you, when I finished up at Motherwell, I was probably a bit fatigued from football because it's brutal. It can batter and bruise you. It's time consuming and it drains you. But when the job came up at Brentford, God, I sound like a footballer now, didn't I? When the job came up at Brentford, it was, you know, I spoke to the CEO and my manager down there, and what they sold to me was correct, is that you've got buy-in from Matthew, who's the owner, who I only saw him 3-4 times in the 2 years that I was there. But, you know, Matthew's the guy that brought people like Rob Rowan down to England to build, because he was so suited to the club and the strategy with recruiting, you know, the way that they want to recruit. And the club just got it. They just understood that they wanted to look after fans. They've got all these older fans that have been coming for years and years, but they knew that they had to try and attract new fans. And they had a plan around how to do that. And part of that was, you know, with the role that they introduced for me, which was, the fan engagement manager role, which was a new role. And they just offered, they just seemed to get the journey that they wanted to go on, and, you know, and they're still on now. And it was quite an exciting role with the new, with the new stadium coming up next year. And, you know, there was a lot to be getting stuck into. So,
what about you mentioned focusing on families and the future fans, and that's always kind of been at the forefront of a lot of your roles as well. How have you looked at breaking down some of those barriers to attending matches that are sometimes seen as being there for that type of audience, a football match?
Yeah, I mean, Brentford was a great example really of that, because, you know, to the more traditional fan, Brentford is perfect. You know, the stadium, you've got floodlights, you've got, you know, terraces, you've got pubs around the ground, and it's great because you know they're playing Leeds tomorrow night, and the atmosphere there will be unbelievable for that reason. That it's a nice ground to be part of, but it's not a nice ground to go to if you're an away fan. But what that challenges that does put you in is if you're a new family. I mean, there is a lot of, you know, new families in London. There are a lot of people in that area of Brentford that have never been to a game. But if you look at what Brentford offers, it offers, you know, sweaty hot dogs, beer inside the ground, barbed wire fence around, you know, parts of the ground, houses that have just crammed this ground, you know, the ground's crammed into. But if you're a new family, you don't want that. If you're you or I, you love it, because that's what football is. That's what midweek football is about. But to a new fan, that's quite a challenge, because you're looking at that thinking, actually, do you want to bring your kids into that? So what we had to do at Brentford was we invested quite heavily in trying to tell our stories of taking our match days outside the ground to the new audience. One, because the current fans can celebrate what a great club that it is. But also, so we could tell the story to new fans, people that are looking, you know, sponsors that are looking at the new stadium or what the club is about, and start to understand the DNA of the club and what match days are like. You know, it's not your typical 40, 50-year-old bloke just drinking beer. There's a lot more that goes into the ground. But to look at it aesthetically, Brentford's probably not that attractive to a new fan. So we built a website that told the story of you know, the club and what it has to offer and what families can do on the match day, and just try to introduce as many initiatives as we can into the match day to make it feel more like a family club. Because in everything that you'd have, you know, seen me go on about in the last 8 years, it's, from my perspective, if you create a Monday morning story, that's the best, that's better than any marketing, corporate marketing message you could ever put out there. If I'm doing something for a family or kids or whatever it may be, that they then go to work on the Monday and tell people about, or to football on the Sunday and tell people about, then that's the best message you can get out there. And we just try to push as many stories like that, of feel good stories as we can, while creating content opportunities on a match day to do that. And it's it's getting there. Brentford did quite a lot before I got there, but they just grew and they needed someone specifically on it. And in my time there, we went from 11th. Out of the 72 league clubs up until second, and you know, that's only behind Middlesbrough, who are they're world class at what they do. But I think, you know, I hopefully have left there in a position where I think they could win Family Club of the Year and this year. And for them, that's for any club, that's massive, because then that's the governing body saying that you're the best club, rather than just people like me in you know, in suits or whatever. It becomes a marketing message of itself, like the governing body telling you you know the best club in the country or the best club in London or whatever. It becomes part of you that, you know, you can then market that to people. So
you mentioned there obviously about the families, and but the key thing is, I suppose, in a lot of the things that you've introduced, you don't have to spend a lot of money, do you?
No, you can do. The best things that you can do are free. And that's what the beauty of what I've tried to do, you know, clubs. I mean, I think, again, Brentford, I worked with the biggest budget I've ever worked with. It wasn't huge, but it was the biggest I've ever worked with. And that allowed us to do a lot of stuff digitally that we've spoken about before, you know, the emails and stuff like that that we'll touch on. But with the free stuff, it's just, you know, it's things like, I mean, Motherwell do it anyway, because I think, well, I don't think Speedy nicked it from me when I did, Philip Speedy, when I was down at Southend, which was just letting kids read the team out before kickoff. And, you know, and letting a home and away fan do it and stuff like that, because from there, you've already created two Monday morning stories or four Monday morning stories, or depending on, you know, parents and stuff. And we did you know, the things that clubs do with putting injured players or suspended players in the club shop before games, just going above and beyond really with every single fan, not to try and create content to go, look at us, we're wow, but just doing things that give people the opportunity to see the club in a different way, rather than the transaction of I've paid my 30 quid or 25 quid or whatever and coming to the ground. It's trying to add value to that. And one of the things we introduced at Brentford was, before a match day, we in the B block, which is our family area, which is probably the size of a kitchen, it's that small. Because on the back of that, you've got houses, and the other side, you've got a football stadium. Is we introduced a thing where we have a big postcard, like a massive postcard that fans, kids can write a message on of good luck. And we do that up until kickoff. Then two kids deliver that to the dressing room before kickoff, to Thomas Frank. And when I proposed that to him in the summer, and I said, look, Thomas, what time can we bring this postcard in? I said, there'll be me, there'll be a parent, and there'll be a kid and a photographer. Never altruistic, honestly. But and he said to me, I'll just bring it in at quarter to three. And I was like, do you mean quarter to two? And he was like, no, bring it in at quarter to three. Because that was his time where the players were just finishing their you know, final preparations. They were out the dressing room. And that then allowed us to go into the dressing room with this massive postcard with a kid who then meets the first team manager and whoever else is in the changing room, and sits there and talks about the game for 2 minutes, about what they think the score is going to be. And that's mind-blowing, and that takes a lot of buy-in from people, you know, at a senior level at the club. But it's, you know, for me, that's the kind of stuff that you can do. Every club in the world could do that. And I wish they did. And I don't believe that clubs compete on a, you know, who's got the best dad or who's got the best mum. It's not that. It's every club should be doing these things because it's free. And, you know, to go into the dressing room 10 minutes before kickoff or 15 minutes before kickoff to deliver a message to the first team manager, to read the team out, to sit on the dugout before kickoff, to, you know, waving flags on the pitch for, you know, before a game, whatever it may be, it costs literally nothing. And the only thing that stops it is egos and the attitude of we've always done it this way. And that's what drives me mad, is that you can change your perceptions of your football club really, really easily if you want to. And that's what really, really winds me up about the, you know, the culture within football, is that clubs, governing bodies could do so much more, but they make the choice not to. And for someone like me, that's quite frustrating, because it's not asking for money, you know, thousands of pounds. It's just trying to change the culture and say, actually, can we offer fans something different, and having a plan of how you're going to deliver it, and knowing that the benefit of doing it probably isn't tangible at this stage, but it means that, you know, those kids that have delivered that postcard or read the team out at Motherwell or Southend or wherever it might be, they're never going to forget that moment. And you create fans for life, I think, by doing those things, just by bringing a little bit of value. And that's when we said at the start about the, you know, fan, what's fan engagement mean to me? And it is those things about adding value.
I definitely won't forget when I was a mascot when I was seven, and that was just being a mascot. That's obviously just walking out on the pitch. That's one aspect of it, but you went into so many more there that, like you said, should be available to all clubs at any level. And I think that's something that can definitely be taken on board by a lot of these clubs, 100%.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier as well that, well, I think we brought it up, that the Brentford are about to move to a new stadium. We've got an example of that up here. Aberdeen are obviously in talks about moving to Kingsford eventually. What are the main things that you think that they should be considering from a fan perspective to incorporate into that new stadium?
To talk to fans is the first thing you need to do, really, and to understand what they want. I think it's very easy for clubs to, especially with something so commercial with a stadium move, it's very easy to get blinded by the naming rights, by the pouring rights and all those things, which are so, so important. But you need to talk to the fans to see what they want in the stadium. They're not going to affect, you know, the construction of it, how it's built or probably what it looks like, but you can colour it in, basically. And you can say, well, the terrible name for them is carnival fans, but the fans that like to be more vociferous, where are they going to be? Where are the families going to be? Where are the people with more disposable income going to be? And just trying to plan that, just trying to map out where each type of fan is going to sit. excuse me. At Brentford, we started some focus groups last year, where we broke down the categories into catering, diversity and inclusion. There was the atmosphere and locations. There was 10 of these groups that we had, and we spent about 2 hours with each. We asked fans to apply for interest, and we wanted about sort of 15-20 fans at each one maximum, because you don't want a massive group, because you then can't, you know, focus. It was talking to smaller groups and working out what, you know, that represented those individual areas of what they wanted, and start shaping the ground that way, really. Because it's so easy to assume. I think that's where clubs have gone wrong in the past. And I know, Charlton did something, didn't they, before with that sofa, when they got that sofa in the ground and stuff like that, which was obviously commercial and you have to work, you know, commercially, but maybe some consultation with fans about stuff like that is important. Because if you consult with fans and they accept the idea or they suggest the ideas, then it's going to penetrate a lot more than someone just coming up with an idea and it being a suit idea. Because if it's a suits idea, it's very easy for fans to dismiss. And I think that would be my advice to Aberdeen, and advice that I gave to, you know, some of the guys at Wimbledon, is just to set up sort of focus groups and talk to fans about what they want. And it might be you have one meeting, it might be you have two or three meetings, but you just have to keep talking and be transparent. And again, that transparency is massive, because if you can't do something, there's no point, you know, saying you can do it or you might do it. It's just being pretty black and white with them and saying, actually, these are the things we can affect, and what do you want it to look like?
On the flip side, I'd seen this season when you were at Brentford, there's some elements of fan bases that are too enamoured with some of this activity. Some might claim it's too Americanised, cheesy. What do you say to those fans, and then those that are maybe put off at clubs because of that sort of reaction they might get?
The stuff that I do, I guess I am guilty of walking into work every day and going, hey, look, it's Disneyland. But you need to just remember that it's not aimed at, you know, the stuff. If I said to my dad now, look, we're going to Leicester, and we're gonna get there an hour and a half before kickoff, and we're gonna go to a fan park, and we're gonna eat a burger there, and we're gonna look at some activities, and we're gonna listen to a band, he'd be like, well, why? We go to the pub, and then at 10 to 3 we leg it from the pub, and in that time we manage to go toilet, grab a hot drink, and just about get our seats. And it's not for those people, really. But if I go with my kids and I say, look, we're going to get there at half one and do all those things, they're absolutely all over it because that's what they want. And I guess coming back to the last question as well, it's just identifying what people's match day routines are. And some don't want to change. Some will never change. But it's wrong of anyone, I think, to criticise why you're doing things for the people that want to engage with it, because that's how you grow. That's how you grow your that's how you grow your loyalty. That's how you identify with different fan groups. And I mean, I've taken absolute belters across, you know, every club I've worked at, really. Scotland as well. But I guess it is because it's very important, but it is very some of it is very American, isn't it? There's no hiding behind it, but America get a lot right, don't they? And that's why you have to try and think, actually, you can't do everything, but little things about how you were trying to add fun to match days or look after certain, you know, fan types, you have to do it because you're not necessarily competing with the football clubs. You're competing with cinemas. You're competing with, you know, Nando's. You're competing with everywhere else in the corporate world that competes with football. You go to the cinema, you know you're going to spend an hour and a half or 2 hours there, get some nice, albeit overpriced snacks, sit down in a nice comfy seat and watch your film for an hour and a half. You go to football, you're going to sit down for an hour and a half, but the rest of it is not going to be, you know, is not guaranteed. And I think unless you can guarantee a 1-0 win every week, you need to have a plan of how you're going to, you know, try and improve things for people. And that's, I guess, how I've always worked. And people that doubt, I mean, I've asked anyone in that's doubted stuff to come and have a conversation. And some just want to be, you know, keyboard warriors and tell you what they think. And some want to, you know, come and listen. I mean, we had a thing at Brentford where we launched a brown and orange kit. A lot of fans absolutely hated it. And I had a conversation with the CEO at the time and the board. They were like, what are we going to do? And I said, well, I think the only way out of this is through complete self-deprecation. Because if we identify ourselves as a football club rather than, especially through social media, I think clubs fall into the trap of sounding like the BBC rather than sounding like a football club that people go to and they do drink, swear and curse. And I said to them, you know, some of the people that have tweeted in or gone on Facebook and said it looks like Jaffa Cakes or looks like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Oompa Loompas, blah, blah, blah. I pulled out about 15, 20 of those comments, not the really vile ones. I couldn't do anything with them. But we just wrote a letter to them all and said, look, we've seen you, don't like the kit. Sorry to hear that. We heard you think it looks like Jaffa Cakes. So in the letter or in the package, we put a packet of Jaffa Cakes and we put an away shirt for them. We had people that said, look like Oompa Loompas. So I sent them the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory DVD. Somebody said it looks like a pair of 70s pants. So I found the biggest pair of 70s pants that I could. People realised that the club was more human than it perhaps had been and had some personality. And I think you just have to, you can't challenge everything that fans say, but you can change perceptions again by just accepting that if you're wrong, just accept that you're wrong and try and have a bit of a, you know, a laugh about it, I think, because that's something that that clubs don't do enough of. And sometimes, I mean, there were a couple of doubters there. There was one guy called Bob who was absolutely negative about the club, and that just changed his perceptions. And all of a sudden, he was just, you know, he I had a chat to him, and he just realised what we were trying to do, and he was an absolute advocate for everything we did after that. And that's not changing thousands and thousands of people, but all of a sudden, we've got one person that then might do something positive on the back of, you know, looking after him. So.
I remember you talking about that one on the previous podcast.
Yeah, I did call that one out. I was just trying to think, remember what podcast that was. But yeah, I was a big fan.
Ryan, say you're at a club that you've just joined or that doesn't have a kind of strategy in place to engage with the fans. What's the first thing on your to-do list?
See what the club have tried to do before, really, if anything. And then just to talk to the fans, talk to the fan groups. That was what we did. You know, Doncaster used to do some great stuff. Mark helped there quite a bit, and then it all became a bit. The club struggled a bit, and then the fans became a bit sort of toxic between the groups. And the first meeting I had there, I was warned that it could get quite heated between two or three different fan groups. and one of the older fan groups who they do some really good stuff with the club, but they were very much, oh, don't go and listen to those two guys over there, don't go and listen to them. And the first thing I did after the meeting was I went and spoke to them and said, why don't you talk to the club? And they presented back some ideas, because they were a younger generation and more vociferous. And they were absolute rascals at times, and they caused me some serious problems, but they had different agendas. And it was just identifying what the older group wanted to do, what the younger group wanted to do, and just trying to sort out the best way forward for the club, as well as talking to the owners about what they want. And I think that's the most important thing you can do, is just talk to the fans and see what they want. Because, again, the wrong thing to do is just to assume that what's right for Brentford, what's right for Motherwell, wouldn't be right for, Southend or for, Aberdeen. And I think every club's individual. So you have to listen to what fans want, what their expectations are, and then just try and deliver on it. And the most important thing I would say as well is if they want 10 things, you don't try and implement the 10 things straight away. Because just get two or three things right initially. Because if you try and do 10 things, then you might well, not do them thoroughly. Try and do two or three things to start with and make a difference that way. And that protects the club, but it also ensures that you deliver to the fans. Fans would rather you deliver two or three things well than try and deliver 10 things, in a pretty average way, I think. So I just think listening to fans is massive.
Best way to listen to them then, obviously you mentioned there at Doncaster you met with them, and I think at Motherwell you maybe introduced a survey when you initially joined as well. What would be the kind of best approach there, do you think?
Both. I think the older generation people, 30 plus, might well want to meet. Are more likely to fill in the survey. And I think the younger people are less likely to want to go online and fill in a load of forms and stuff. So you have to approach each audience differently, really. And I even did that at Motherwell. I met with, Derek, Watson and the Well boys down there. And, I still keep in touch with Derek, now. I think Motherwell are a lovely, lovely club. And we had the older fans that perhaps did the survey, and then we identified, two or three of those, or four or five of those for the some sort of fan content we wanted to do after that for season tickets and stuff. And it's, and same with Doncaster, a lot of clubs have old fan bases. That's the problem. Unless you're a Celtic, Rangers, Chelsea, Man City, you're not cool enough to probably get young kids that want to, you've got the players that young kids want to be. So it happens quite naturally, but you have to reach out to, because that's a terribly American term, isn't it? there I go. You have to reach out to every single fan and ask for feedback. And like I'm saying, surveys can be as detailed as you want, but the biggest thing for me, and the best question to ever ask, is just, what does the club mean to them? Stories and interests and things that will help you understand, what the club is about. Because again, you can assume, you think, what the club is about, but until I went to Motherwell and worked there, I didn't, really know much. I'd seen them on Alba and wondered why I couldn't understand what the commentator was saying, which is a true story. But I think when you work at a club like that, which is a steel town, it's a working class steel town, it's hard for you to, and Doncaster was the same, but with mining, it's really hard to understand what those people have been through in their lives, the families have been through, which has made them support that football club rather than another football club. And you have to just understand, what the club's about to make any impact at all.
I mean, regular communication is obviously extremely important. One of the things that I noticed with the work that was going on down at Brentford when you were there, Ryan, was your emails and just how colourful they were and the information that was included in them. Can you, for those that haven't maybe seen them, give us a flavour of what sort of information was included in them, and what, how often did you send them out?
Yeah, we had to put it into context for you as well of why we could do so many, and it is scalable. This is, we had two people that worked on emails specifically. That's all they did, on the data. But then Brentford is built on data, isn't it? So there's a massive need for an understanding of that. And we used to send fans if they registered as new, they'd get an email welcoming to the club and telling them some information about the club. If they were coming to a game, they'd get an email on the Thursday just telling them what was on at the game, if they were collecting tickets, where to collect them from, if they were printing their tickets, what to do, and all that kind of stuff. Or if they were families, here's all the entertainment that's going on around the game. You can meet the players here. You can meet the mascots here. This is how you have a chance to read the team out. This is how you have a chance to write a message. This is how you have a chance to choose the playlist. And we just targeted every single audience differently. So we knew where they bought the ticket, what experience they wanted. So it was then just serving them the content that they wanted, before the match. After the game, we surveyed, I think, anywhere between 1,500 and 2,000 fans a game on back to those touch points of how was the game experience, blah, blah, blah. And what we found, which was really, really interesting, was even last season where we went 8 games without winning, our satisfaction rates actually went up because of what we were trying to do for the fans. And we were trying to get them to take out the football from the survey and talk about what their experience was like. And the actual satisfaction went up, which was quite, which was quite unexpected, really. Some of the other emails that we didn't do it with every bit of news, but if there was a player renewing his contract, we'd send that to season ticket holders half an hour before it went public. And there was a bit of conflict there. Season ticket holders and members. There was a bit of conflict there because the comms team said, "Well, we want to tell." They wanted to do it through, through the official way. We are delighted to announce blah blah blah. But I said, "But this news costs us nothing, and if we give it to our season ticket holders first of all and our members, all of a sudden it adds value to them. Oh, I'm getting this first. If they then go and tell the world, then brilliant, because they're probably more likely to tell the world that they've heard it than they are if we just announce it normally and just do a retweet or whatever it might be." So we started putting content together for contract renewals, some of the signings, which gave, like I say, added value for those supporters. And we also did stuff. The best thing that we did that got the biggest engagements ever was at the end of the season, where we could track the data of when people had come into the ground. We could track what games they'd bought, away tickets they'd bought through the club. And we could work out from their postcode how far coming to a game and back was. So we calculated all the mileage from home to the games that they went to and back, from home to the away games that they went to and back. And we could put that into an email at the end of the season. So actually, do you know what? You've travelled 10,000 miles this season to watch Brentford. As part of that, you saw Ollie Watkins score 3 hat-tricks. You saw Ben Rama score 2 penalties. You saw our biggest attendance of the season, et cetera, et cetera. And then every single fan had a tailored email that was a summary of their season. It's so easy for clubs that have got access to data to start calculating those things up. You do need support, and we had that through an external agency, but it's so easy if you've got access to that, just to personalise emails, because if you get a personalised email, it means more to you than dear supporter or dear customer, as you sometimes get. And it was so, that then creates a lot of content online because fans are tweeting, "Oh, how far did you travel? How many games did you see?" And we even had one fan that missed one game because he had to go to his work's Christmas party. So we had to do this manually, but we tailored his, "You came to every game, or you came to 45 games and one Christmas party." So we then just sent him a little Father Christmas gift with it and stuff like that. And it just allows you to be more engaging, because then the club are seeing you as a supporter rather than just as a number, because I think clubs fall into that massively. I mean, I say supporting less, the amount of stuff that I get is that's not personalised, that's telling me to buy a membership. And I think, well, I'm a season ticket holder, I don't need that. And it turns you off straight away. You think, oh, I'm just a transaction. But the other stuff that I've always tried to do with those emails is just to try and add value, knowing that the transactions will eventually come.
Great. I mean, you've mentioned loads, Middlesbrough being one club. Is there any other sort of clubs out there, organisations you look at, whether it's in the UK or abroad, that you go for inspiration and you think are doing some great stuff?
I went across to Denmark last year, just again for a look at what some of the clubs there do. The reason I started looking out there was because I'd heard about Bromby and the and the fan area that they've got there, the supporter area, which I think cost 1.6 million euros or something like that, which is obviously, you're very unlikely to get that in England unless you've got a city square or something like that. But it was just to understand the culture, really, of why they did it and the commercial benefits to it and the fan benefits to it. And what I uncovered there was that the ultras who, I mean, I went behind at that south side with one of their SLOs who he had tattoos on his calves that were the size of a kebab shank. And he had like Bromby ultras, but he worked for the club. And he just had that respect behind the goal. And he introduced me to a few of the people behind that goal, that, you know, the capos and all those types of people. And they were then telling me that they helped decorate the family area. There was a five-a-side pitch built in the family area that the ultras then, you know, designed and graffitied and all that kind of stuff. And although you got a family and those ultras, which are two separate fans, it was about how they all worked together. And that's something I really saw in Denmark, was how they, every club has its own identity, whether it be Bromby or, you know, Copenhagen, Copenhagen are so, so commercial, and they're such an English club, if you like. You can see the way that they are so, so commercial about everything, but they've got their fans that are, you know, absolutely brilliant, you know, as well. But the culture in Denmark was just fantastic, and that's something that, I don't know if you've ever looked at FC, I can never say it properly, but FCN, which is FC Nordsjælland out there, and their model is unbelievable, where it's literally, I think 98% of their fan base are families, and they don't care about anyone else, because they know if they've got a massive audience like families, commercial partners will come, because they've got a smaller audience, but they've got a more relevant audience. And the culture out there, with the relationships between the fans and the clubs, was massive out there. And bringing that background, is that's what I saw with Thomas Frank. Thomas Frank was able to identify, actually, do you know what? We need to go and clap the fans at the end of the game, whether we've won 4-0 or lost 4-0. I need to be honest with the fans if we've lost 4-0 or won 4-0. And he had the culture of players that the players just wanted to be part of it as well. The players didn't have to be asked to do stuff. And that's something that I think has come from that Scandinavian, you know, the culture, is that they just want to be, they want the club and the fans to be together. And I think you see it, I think you do see it at other clubs, but Brentford is quite unique like that. And I just think that's down to the owners and down to Thomas Frank and his, you know, Scandinavian roots. And even Pontus, in Pontus, you know, he's a massive, massive name, massive, massive person. But even he would do a signing in the club shop and then run off for 20 minutes so he can talk to the kids in the young kid in the changing room and then come back out if he's not playing. And I think it's just that's something that every club should look at, I think, is the culture abroad, especially in, you know, in Denmark, because I was just literally blown away by it.
And you didn't even mention Midtjylland there, who are obviously like affiliated with Brentford Ivor, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I think, you know, the stuff that they're trying to do, you know, I spoke to Marcus from there quite a bit, and he was very, Marcus Morton from there quite a bit, and he was very interested in the junior takeover days that we do over here quite a lot. And, you know, we did one at Brentford where we invited invited children from the community trust projects to come and do our jobs on a match day. But rather than just inviting supporters or members or friends of the club, we went to the community trust and said, actually, let's invite some of your children with disability. Let's invite some of your aspiring girl footballers. Let's invite some of the boys that were on the academy. And we just went through every pillar of the trust and then invited them to be part of the match day. And as a result of doing that, we ended up with investment from one of the girl that was the junior Thomas Frank for the day. Her dad then invested with the trust. And I think it's just trying to understand that, coming full circle, really, is if you invest in the supporters in the right way, then you can, everyone sees reward eventually.
No, great. And then I'll just put to our examples to shame, because I don't think either of us will be going into depth quite like that. Ryan, I think that's a good juncture to finish it up there with you. Just before we finish off, obviously we do our things that we've liked. Chris, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll go first. I've got one from Scottish Golf. They obviously from a sports marketing Scotland perspective, rather than just focusing on football, they've launched kind of a new logo this week, a new website, and are promising a new approach to kind of move themselves forward as an organisation into a more kind of digital when perhaps they weren't previously. So that'll be interesting to follow over the coming months as they bring that to life a bit more. And one of the big ones that I spotted on Twitter, somebody mentioned it to me, I think it was Moza, who we've previously mentioned on the BSC Glasgow podcast. He spotted that Berwick Rangers had hijacked one of Limmy's Twitch streams to get him to announce a new signing this week, which I think he must offer like shout outs for maybe a small donation or something like that. So Berwick have hijacked that. Caught my eye, kind of as if we didn't have any more unique and new ways to announce signings. There's another one that pops up.
Yeah, I also noticed Berwick Rangers are crowdfunding, and they've been very open and honest about where the money's going to be going, and they want it to invest in the squad next season. I think obviously they've dropped down from League Two into Lowland League, which is a very competitive league. So all the best to them there. My examples, I've got two. One completely not football or sport related at all. There's a gentleman on Twitter called Dan Barker, at Dan Barker, and he tweeted that for every like that his tweet got, he would reply with a e-commerce tip. He's got over 1,000 likes, so he's a very busy man, but there's a lot of great tips there for anybody and clubs at all levels that will be running an online store that they could get some quick wins from there. And second of all, my other example is Kilmarnock. We had Scott on the podcast probably about this time last year, actually, talking about in-house content and the plans that they had. They rolled out Kelly TV not long after. They've recently launched a podcast, and now they've got a digital show called Kelly Nation. So I think it's they've looked into how they want to get that story of Kilmarnock and across and touch all those different touch points, and they are hitting out different audiences with different content. So yeah, no, good, good to see that they've really gone from strength to strength there as well.
Definitely. Ryan, thank you again very much for coming on the podcast. Great chatting to you.
Thank you.
Cheers.